TFM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, before we get started, I just want you to remember one thing. A Rigelian tiger pounces without warning.
Chris, I know if you haven't seen the torn uniform that I have on right now and the scars on my chest. Yes, I have been under Noonien Singh's tutelage this week. And, well, let's just say things haven't gone swimmingly.
I was going to say, it sounds like you need to go through the course again.
Well, yeah. Threats never sleep. So I also haven't slept much.
I love that line delivered by Ortegas. It's such
it's fantastic.
You're a cadet, aren't you? You should know this. Yeah. You've got a fun ride in store for you in this training. Yes, everyone, we are going to continue our exploration of the first season of Strange New Worlds today. This is episode 6 of the season. It is titled Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach. And here's a quick rundown of the story. When Captain Pike returns to Majalis, a planet where he once took part in a rescue mission, he meets a woman whom he may have been hitting on a decade earlier. While it may be crazy and unlikely that they are meeting again, Pike has arrived just in time to save her and a young boy from attack. Coincidence? Perhaps. But the situation is far more complicated than it seems, and Pike finds himself faced with a troubling reality that he cannot stop when it turns out that the boy is destined to be sacrificed for the good of Majalan society. Meanwhile, the world's medical technology holds the promise of saving Mabenga's daughter. So, Matthew, that is a completely incomplete summary of what happens in this episode, because there is a lot going on here, and it's a interestingly deeper episode following up Spock Amok, which is one thing that I like about this series, that they're balancing the lighter stories and then the heavier stories in a way that we used to get in Star Trek, and I think it's good for the series.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think this just shows you that you can obviously have loose continuity with shows and do more episodic television and it really work. And so I really appreciate it. In fact, in many ways, I feel like this show has felt a little bit like the seasons of The Mandalorian, where you've got this loose continuity happening, you're kind of building story, but each episode feels like its own adventure as well, so you can just watch that episode and you don't feel like you necessarily have to have watched every episode.
Or, yeah,
you know, you can just pick and choose episodes that are your favorite and you can go back and rewatch and stuff. And I think that's one of the things that Strange New Worlds is really doing well. We normally don't start like this, but you had put on the outline the idea of the first servant. And I just wanted to ask you right up front, because this is the first episode of the series where I feel like I've actually had structural story issues that didn't really seem to make sense to me. And so I wanted to ask you about them, because this is an incredibly advanced society.
Yeah.
And it says, They talk about their founders creating this way of life, but I don't understand, one, why you would be on this planet if you don't have to be. It doesn't seem like these people evolved here.
Right.
And so it's like they chose this planet to live on and then realized, oh, to actually live on this planet, we'd have to like sacrifice a child every so often so that we can live in floating cities.
Yeah.
Which basically look like Avatar Naboo.
Actually, yeah, they do.
Right? So I felt like the basic structure of the story, the foundation, there is no foundation to this story because it doesn't really make sense to me why this is even a thing. Like, why would you make this choice if you could go live on any other planet and not have to make this choice? Like, to me, that was the basic question. And the show never even attempts to answer that other than to say, yeah, our founders created this, you know, however many hundreds of years ago. And I'm like, really, hundreds of years? You've been doing this for hundreds of years? Like, why would you choose this planet to live on in the first place?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. And it feels like one of those science fiction stories where the writers have a point to make or a message they want to share or an issue they want to explore. And so they come up with a setup for it that allows them to do that. But because it's a single episode in the case of television, or if you imagine this as being a science fiction short story or a novel, you don't have the space to set up the history and the background of it all. So you kind of throw the reader or the viewer in to the story and ask them to just accept that this is how things are so you can move forward with the story. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, a case in TOS of like the cloud minders, because you've got the floating city and you've got the people that live up above the ground, although that is a somewhat different story. Although it is using someone else to keep the people who are above the surface to maintain their way of life, you know, using someone else. But anyway, in this one, it reminded me of in the original series in particular, and maybe in TNG a bit as well, those Star Trek stories where you find a society where things are run by a computer or a machine, and the people just accept that this is how things are, and they don't really understand how it works, and they don't want to make a change. And when our heroes come in from the outside and they observe it, they think, well, this is kind of an odd way to live, and this is something you probably shouldn't be doing. And in this story, it goes to another extreme, because they're literally killing children to keep themselves floating in the air.
I mean, I think this is just, like, I do understand what you're saying, and I think it's 100% right. Like, you have a contrivance that is there to tell a story, and, you know, most of science fiction is like that. But I feel like, you know, this one just jumped out at me is like, they didn't do a good enough job of making it work. Because, like, again, these people are super advanced, like more advanced than the Federation in terms of their technology and stuff. Like, they don't, and it's not like they tied the fact that technology is what it is because of the First Servant.
Right.
You know? And so, or that they have to be on this planet. I mean, their planet is like apparently Mustafar.
I guess
basically.
So. I mean, it's covered with lava and lakes of acid. And so they could not have evolved there unless they evolved there and there was some great disaster that covered the planet and they escaped to this city. But there's no indication that that's what happened in the story.
Well, and then, like, so I think that, again, as we're talking through this, the logic of this just doesn't make any sense. And therefore, the illogical nature of the episode is what actually hurts it to me. And because I do think that it is trying to say something very interesting. And you hit on it, this idea that they are willing to sacrifice the life of a child to keep their way of life. And that they deem it worthy and necessary to do so. And that's, I think, very pointed for the world we live in today. I think there are many places where you could point to where we see those type of things happening, and we just accept it, and or it's not even that we don't accept it. We just pretend it doesn't exist so that we can
reap the benefits.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, because in this story, certainly they deem it necessary because, as Alora says, the city will fall out of the sky otherwise. Mm-hmm. Whether they deem it worthy, I'm not sure, because she makes that comment near the end of the episode where she tells Pike that the goal of her research 10 years before mm-hmm. when they met was to try to find a way to have this machine work and keep the city afloat without the need to have a first servant that gets connected to it. So I think they acknowledge that it's something that they shouldn't do and they don't want to do, but they have no alternative. And the fact that that was part of her research 10 years ago, and she's now witness to the ceremony, and she even invited Pike to the ceremony and oddly said, I want you to be part of this. And I say oddly because I think that she knows or should know from being around him, even a short time, that this is not something that he would accept.
Yeah.
And so why would you want him to be part of the ceremony? That was a bit odd. And it was also odd that they would allow him to be the first outsider to ever witness the ceremony in the first place. So that's another odd thing about the story.
I think there's also that false dichotomy that they're creating, like that there's no other way. That's not true. There's always another way. And the other way is to not live on this freaking planet.
Well, yes. Yeah.
Like,
of course.
You know, and like you don't have to do this, but you're choosing to do it. And I think the willful choice, again, to sacrifice a child for one's way of life and or convenience is a terrifying thing that this episode does present us with. And I think it is something to which the episode is saying, you need, as a human race, to think about yourselves at this moment in the 21st century. How are you doing this? And where are you doing this? Mm-hmm. And then you need to think about, do you have, quote unquote, a choice? Yes, you do. And you need to make a different choice, because as Pike's revulsion shows us, that's the revulsion that we should all have on these things. And I think I'm not pointing fingers at just anybody. I'm thinking specifically myself in the way in which, where do I make this a reality by supporting any place, companies or anything that would revolve around children being, you know, used in labor, or, you know, that's one issue. I mean, again, there are so many places we could look at, right?
Yeah.
But that's what this episode is challenging us to do. And I think that it's really uncomfortable. And I love the way that Anson Mount plays it, because he gets so uncomfortable because he doesn't have a choice. These people are not part of the Federation, and there's absolutely nothing he can do for this child now. Like, it doesn't even matter. Like, there's no repercussions for him.
Yeah.
The disturbing thing here is that I think you pointed out something that I found really kind of gross about the episode, is that these people, they've been trying to hide all these things from the Federation on purpose. They never joined the Federation because they knew that they wouldn't approve. They were never going to go. I mean, the Federation would never allow a member to join with this being part of their way of life. And so, yes, it did kind of seem strange that she invites Pike to witness the ceremony when she should know, he's not going to be cool with this.
Right. Yeah. Now, we're not told in the story if they want to be part of the Federation and they've chosen not to join the Federation because they're hiding this. We don't know if that's the case.
Well, but remember, they had been offered Federation membership and they never took it.
Yeah.
And she says, she mentions the fact that they didn't join the Federation, that they do things on their own. And so it does, I mean, at least I took it as a deliberate choice because they knew the Federation wouldn't approve.
Well, it is a deliberate choice not to join the Federation, right? Yeah. whether it was purely to hide this practice, I don't know for sure, but it seems likely that that would be the case. And in that case, it is odd that she would invite the captain of the Enterprise in to witness what was going on. And, you know, the boy himself did not understand what he was heading into either. And they have this line. She asks him. This is the other thing that gets me about this. I was saying earlier that part of her research was to try to find an alternative a decade earlier. But as you were saying, I think they've come to accept this as just something that they do. And so Alora, she may have been looking for a solution in the past, but she doesn't seem to be looking for a solution anymore, because not only is she party to the ceremony, she actually asks the boy, "Do you freely offer this gift of self to the people of Majalis?" And he says, "With joy and gratitude, I do." And she says, "Do you freely choose your fate?" And he says he does. And then when he sees the husk of the previous first servant, he's like, "Oh my God." And but he still goes through with it, I think, because he feels like that's his duty. In his society, he was the one that was selected, but he didn't know what was really going to happen, which makes me think that the society as a whole is not aware of what is being done to these children, that there's a small circle of people who know exactly what's going on.
Right.
So that adds another layer of texture to the story and the situation in the society.
I mean, I'm so glad that you brought this up, Chris, because I think that this episode is also absolutely saying children should not be able to make life-altering decisions as children. They're children. They don't understand the ramifications of the choices that they are making. And just think about this. We know as human beings, our brains aren't fully developed until the age of 25. So, you know, the idea that a child can make this choice and have any true understanding of what they're choosing like this, I think is ridiculous. And so
now they present him like he's a genius, but that doesn't mean that he comprehends the ramifications of these things.
Well, and knowledge is not the same thing as wisdom. And wisdom only comes from experience.
Right, yep.
And wisdom only comes from having enough experience to rightly apply knowledge. So he doesn't have enough experience to rightly apply all of the knowledge that he has. Yeah, he's a genius kid in the sense of, like, he understands a lot of technological things. He has a lot of knowledge, but he doesn't have any wisdom. And therefore, again, that's what it means for then adults to be raising children, to train them up in the way they should go, so that they can then hopefully do that once they reach adulthood. You know, I mean, this kid isn't anywhere close to that.
Right.
And so I really do think this episode is saying so much about our society and how we treat children and what we allow them to do. And I'm fascinated because I don't know. To me, this just seems very different than a lot of the messages that we kind of get out there. And so in a lot of ways, I was pretty shocked, but absolutely pleased to see what this episode was having to say, because I think it's a good thing for us to think through what we're doing to our kids.
Yeah. Well, his father, Gamal, seems to be one of the people that does know what happens. Because that's why he's trying so hard to prevent his son from being able to ascend in the first place. And that's where the whole neural dampener thing came in. That he was, I don't know exactly how the neural dampener would work, but he was willing to use that on his son as a way of ultimately protecting him because otherwise he knew that the result would be that his son would be giving his life so that the Cloud City can stay afloat and these people can live in their idyllic environment. That environment also, another thing that I think all the stuff we're talking about right now, I think is the primary message of the episode because it's focused on our world today and how we function as a society. And so many people are closed off from the realities of where the products we consume come from, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, he reminded me a bit of a Messiah and thinking about how we view our society, our world, and how it came about and why it's the way it is, in the sense that he is a child who is selected and sacrificing himself so that everyone else can live in this sort of paradise, because this Cloud City is like that. They don't have disease. They have extraordinary technology. It's a beautiful environment. It is like a paradise, and it exists because there is this one child who is sacrificing themselves for everyone else. And that also stood out to me because of the contrast between their technology and then what they're doing here with this first servant, that their technology is so advanced, way, way more advanced than the Federation. I think even the Federation that we know a century later, you know, in the TNG era. And yet they have no solution for something as simple as keeping the city floating in the air, which you rightly point out doesn't make any sense in the story. But I think part of the reason that that's in the story is that it is contrasting the belief, the faith in something that we can't understand, in this case, how the machine works, while at the same time, we do understand so many of the mysteries of the universe from a scientific perspective, and we can create all of these advanced technologies that we have.
I see what you're saying, and I think it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think the difference here is they're continually sending children to death.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's not just child sacrifice. It's a
It's not a one for all. Right. You know, we're not talking Jesus here.
Right.
We're talking like if Jesus had to come every year, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's
because I don't think they specify in here either how long a first servant is connected to this machine, but it can't be long because they're still a child when they bring the husk out.
Yeah, absolutely. So you get the feeling like this happens multiple times, you know, maybe it's every few years, but still, I mean, again, so they say that they understand, that the society itself understands and reveres, you know, the first servant for the decision that they make to, you know, be the basic savior for however long it is. And yet, it's what I think it is it's just semantics. And I think we see this in our world today, where you're playing semantical games so you can get away with what you want to, so it doesn't make you feel bad for what you're doing.
Yeah, sure.
But this is the thing, right? Like, this is why I can't believe that there's not a permanent right and wrong for everyone, because everybody watches this episode and they're going to go, that's wrong. Why do you feel like that? Why? Because you know instinctively that there is a true right and wrong that goes beyond yourself, because you see this episode just like Pike does, and you're like, no, I can't accept, regardless of what your cultural tradition is, that's wrong.
Yeah.
Because we're sacrificing it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just think, again, this episode, like, the more we're talking about, the more even though I have the frustration with the construct of the episode and the lack of foundation and it making sense, what the episode is actually saying, I think, is phenomenal.
Yeah. Okay, so the Pike thing, I put an item on our outline. I called it Hotel Majalis because I was thinking a bit of the Eagles song Hotel California.
Nice. It's, I love it.
It's not exactly the same situation, but I did write down, you know, Pike. There's a chance that they can help him in the future. And to take advantage of that, he can check in anytime he likes, but he can never leave because they don't share their medical technology. And he could have access to it if he agreed to become one of them, to live on Majalis, to live as they do, Alara tells him. And I thought that this really strengthened the message of the episode, because here you have Pike. Well, first of all, it was nice that they revisited his knowledge of what's going to happen to him 10 years from now without making it a central part of the story, without spending too much time on it. It's just there. We know that we're reminded that this knowledge is guiding Pike in some way. Mm-hmm. As it would anyone, I think, who has that knowledge of their future. But he's making his own decisions and not selfish decisions related to this, because after what he witnessed, there's no way, even if he knew, he would literally die, not just be confined to this chair. There's no way that he could come live here and accept this medical care, knowing why the society is able to continue existing in the first place through sacrificing these children. And so he's put in a situation where, yeah, there's an opportunity. It could benefit him, but the price is far too high for him. And the way the episode ends with him staring out the window, I think really reinforces that.
I 100% agree with you. You know, I think Pike is put in this kind of terrible position because with the medical technology that this place has, there's a good chance he wouldn't live like that forever.
Right.
You know, and obviously we know in the future he's going to go, you know, he's going to be fine. Well, he's going to get to live a life that, you know.
Just to interject, that's the thing about prequels is that the fact that this is a prequel and they do have to follow a certain story does weaken this point a bit, because we know there's no way he could. We know he doesn't consider it. He doesn't go back there.
Sure.
But it weakens it just a little bit. I don't think it negates the the message.
Well, but, you know, what I think is interesting is that when you're doing the prequel too, you are wrapped up in the storyline for that character at that moment.
Right.
Yeah, we might have that knowledge of what happens in the past, but I'm still feeling what Pike is feeling, which is this loss of this possibility, not just for a life maybe outside the chair after the accident because of this, you know, Majalis, but maybe life with somebody that there was a connection with. There was this feeling of like that there was something special about them together, and they will never get to experience that again because they are literally from completely different worldviews, and their worldviews do not connect with what Pike learns. She becomes someone to which I don't think he could actually ever truly even consider loving again, because she holds to this thing which he sees as being honestly evil. I mean, I think, you know, I hate to put it in those kind of like black and white terms, but I think he would call this evil, right?
Yeah.
And you can't be with somebody that you feel like is actually, it's not just an ideological difference that can be overcome. But yeah, he would see this as evilness. So I feel really, I do feel terrible for Pike in this episode because, I mean, he gets some good loving, you know. He finds somebody he really connects with, he can talk easily with, you know. They're both people who understand leadership and all those things, so they have that kind of understanding. And then he finds this out and it just dashes all of those hopes.
Yeah.
And what's interesting here is that I I do feel like Alora opens herself up to Pike, hoping that he will accept her in their way of life.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, it's just, he's never going to make that deal with the devil.
Yeah.
You know, to him, that is basically making a deal with the devil. And he can't live with a person or in a place that would see this as being the right course of action.
Right. But as you were talking about earlier, there are structural problems with this story. I think this is one as well.
Yeah.
After not seeing him for 10 years, why would she immediately want him to stay there with her and be her partner and become part of their society?
Well, that was after, you know, they... and
so that moment in bed changed her mind.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Yep. I see.
That's my thought is apparently Pike's good. So,
well, it
which
makes
I
sense.
Would under, I would suspect. I mean, he looks like a virile man, you know. So, and his pompadour is outrageous.
Who could resist that hair?
I don't know. I that's what I'm saying. He's got good hair, great looks, and apparently,
and he's got
just
a sense of humor. So he is the
exactly
the whole package.
Yeah,
as they say,
he's the captain on the ship, and he's the captain in bed. So.
Is that going to be the title of the episode?
I hope so, because that one just came out of nowhere, and it was like, wow.
Oh, boy, that'll put us number one in Apple Podcasts right there.
It will. It will. People all are right. Like, I got to listen to that episode.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the other element of this story that gives us some loose continuity. I thought it was a nice connection, and that's Mbenga and the situation with his daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I liked in the previously on part of the opening where they have the line from him that somewhere out there, there's a planet that has the technology that he needs, the solution that he needs. And he encounters it here. And they do that thing, which we've talked about before, of turning the table on the Federation, where often it's the Federation that says that we cannot share our technology with other people if they're not part of our group. And then here, the Magellans are saying the same thing, which makes sense. Although when you think about it, yeah, part of the reason could be that they have this thing that they're hiding. Although I don't necessarily see those things as being connected. I think that because Gamel lost his son, he wasn't able to save him. That was what pushed him to open up to Mbenga and try to help as a way of, well, I can't help my child. Maybe I can help another. Prior to that, he wasn't willing to share the information and was actually kind of condescending about Starfleet's medical technology in the first place. But this part of the story I did feel was a nice bit of writing to create that continuity for the character of Mbenga in a situation that's not directly related to him.
I really liked this because I also, this isn't a thing that personally I want to drag on forever.
No.
And so I think by allowing us this first step in him finding a way to save his daughter is awesome, you know, and I appreciate the fact that, you know, yeah, we're in episode 6. And so maybe if it's not by the end of this season, maybe it's early next season where we get the opportunity to have her, you know, be saved, you know, to have her be able to have this problem fixed, which I love. And I also, you know, I got the feeling like he understood that when Mbenga was telling the story, that it was for somebody that was special to him.
Yeah.
And again, it was like a father to father moment.
Right.
There.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I love that we're showing here is that Mbenga and Gamel are good fathers. You know, they make the right choices for their children in the end. And I think many times fathers are given kind of a bad rap, especially on television. And so I love seeing good fathers portrayed on television. I think we need more of that because I think children need good representation of what good fatherhood looks like. Maybe they don't get it at home. So a show like this gives them an opportunity to actually see what that looks like. You know, I think that's the beauty of, you know, we talk about Deep Space Nine all the time on The Orb, and that's one of the things we both love about that show, mm-hmm. right? For guys, too, who both have father issues. We both
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
But to see Avery Brooks and the way that he plays that with Cirroc Lofton, to know that that actually transcended television, that he considers him
yeah.
a surrogate father, basically.
Yeah.
I think that there's something beautiful about that. So well, I really, really appreciate the way that they took this story with Mbenga and his daughter. And I find it to be one of those moving things, honestly, about the series. I think it's heart-wrenching
mm-hmm.
To watch, but it's also beautiful. And so I'm really excited for the opportunities that they have with the storytelling here with him and saving his daughter. And I hope for him, just as the character, that it happens sooner rather
right.
than later.
Yeah, it's one of those storylines that, like you said, I don't want to see it dragged out season after season, right? It's
right, exactly.
It's something that makes him who he is. And it's like an open wound that needs to be closed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will be closed in a way that brings his daughter back.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
that's
yeah.
part of his character growth. And it needs mm-hmm. to happen without being dragged on for too long so that we can then continue to grow the character more. I don't want this to be like the one to
yeah,
play. It's like with Odo. If Odo had not found out who his people are until the end of season 7, it would have been way too long, right? We could not have developed...
Yeah, that would have been terrible.
Well, we could not have developed Odo as a character
exactly.
the way that they did if they allowed that story to just linger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned yeah. that it's wonderful that Cirroc came to see Avery as like a surrogate father, but I think it's equally and maybe more wonderful that Avery felt that way about Cirroc and mm-hmm. brought him
Absolutely.
In, you know, because Avery
Absolutely.
Has his own children, and then he brought Cirroc
yeah.
in,
mm-hmm.
and Cirroc has said before that, you know, Avery Brooks would take him to basketball games and introduce him as his
yep.
son.
Yeah.
And that's
And can
wonderful.
You imagine mm-hmm. anything more heartfelt, like the love that it takes to do that is astounding, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's really great, again, just to be able to see that representation, because family is so important. And sometimes we're not blessed with the best families we're born into. And so I think this gives us the opportunity, and good shows can help us be able to see things maybe we don't get to see in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I appreciate that they're doing that with this show.
Yeah.
So
that is one thing that, despite the flaws that we see in the series, I think one thing that Star Trek Discovery has done well, especially in its third season, was that idea of found families and the fact that we come together with people that we may not be biologically related to, but that we form bonds with and support each other and actually find a sense of family. Not to take us back to a negative place here with the character in the story, but talking about Gamble being a good father, I mentioned earlier that I think he's one of the people who did know what happens to these children, which is why he wants to save his son. But there is that scene where he's talking to Number One and he admits that he has betrayed his beliefs and betrayed his principles, which I think is part of the story that you started talking about at the beginning and how society is today and how we often turn a blind eye to things until they affect us. He's been okay with this until his son was the one chosen by lottery to ascend And then he took the steps to prevent that from happening.
I mean, it's our worst inclination as human beings is, and say this as plainly as possible, we're all absolute hypocrites. We just are. And I think the thing to me, just personally, and I'm just going to speak for myself for a moment, but the thing for me is that the beliefs that I hold are the ones that help make me less of a hypocrite, but also make me aware of my hypocrisy in the first place, right? And so I think you're absolutely right in pointing out, and I'm so glad that you did, because I think it's 100% true. Most of us are willfully ignorant, or as Pink Floyd would say, comfortably numb to the world we live in until things affect us, and then they become real.
Yeah.
And I do think, again, that is the beauty of this episode, is it is trying to shake us out of our moronic malaise that we are in, where we say one thing and do another. And it's our actions that define us. And so if we are to look at our actions, yes, we are a society who's willing to sacrifice children for our way of life, our convenience, our ideology, all of these things, just as this episode is showing us that they were willing to do. And we're not any better. So we need to look at ourselves in the mirror and make a change, as Michael Jackson would say.
Yeah.
You know? And I think I think the beauty of this episode is how honest it is in that. I love that you pointed out, because that's honesty from Gamble. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't care about this until it affected me.
Yeah.
But I now realize that everything I held dear was something that I can't hold to anymore. So, yeah. I don't know. It's just a really sobering episode, in all honesty.
It is. Yeah. Definitely is. What are your final thoughts, and what's your rating for this one?
I thought, you know, the setup for the episode is so contrived to get us where we want to go thematically that the episode could have, if it had been better done, this would have been a 5-star episode easily. But I think that this episode is so challenging for our society that I'm still going to give it 4 out of 5. And part of that is, I think Anson Mount's fantastic in this episode, in his portrayal of Pike. You know, he's so lighthearted at the beginning, thinking mm-hmm. that this is going to be a easy mission, and it turns out to be one of his most heart-wrenching missions. And especially because he feels powerless by the end, which nobody likes to feel. But this episode also has fun little moments too, you know, just the whole thing in the transporter room where he can't even speak because, you know, he's got this old flame here.
Yeah.
All of the stuff with Uhura and Noonien Singh is fantastic. You know, I thought that was a really nice part of the episode. Again, continuing building their characters and who they are. So all in all, I mean, if they had tweaked some of the setup for this episode and given us just a little bit more on this society and made it even more necessary feeling for this thing to actually happen, I think that would have been a much better episode. But all in all, I mean, I'm hard pressed to find a time when we've had a more serious, in-depth discussion
mm-hmm.
than this episode.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking that they could have just added a line where they explain that there's been a natural disaster and they've been forced to live in the city.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I think even that would not solve the structural problem, because their technology is so advanced, they could easily move somewhere else. They don't have to be on this planet. So,
I mean, isn't Prospect 7, you know?
Like, yeah.
There's so, other places to live.
Right. So there's that. But again, sometimes in science fiction, you do just establish a situation so that you can explore an issue. And you don't always have to make it, you know, this isn't hard sci-fi. You don't have to make it all make perfect sense, especially when you don't have time to build. You know, you can't do world building in one episode for a society that we're only going to see once. So that's fine. I like the Uhura part as well. We didn't talk about it today because it was not the focus of the episode or the message, but it is nice how they're moving her from department to department because it exposes us to different areas of the ship, different roles that officers play, builds her character, pairs her with other characters. And I think it's a smart way to develop not only Uhura, but the other people that she interacts with. I'm a little bit concerned that Hemmer was not in this episode again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about that and why he's so rarely in the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see more of him. I haven't gone to do the research to find out if it's a schedule problem mm-hmm. or what. Although if it's a schedule problem with the actor in the first season of a 10-episode series, that would be a little bit disconcerting. It's not like Cole Meany shooting movies yep. during the 7-year, yep. 26-episode per season run of Deep Space Nine.
We did see Sam Kirk, and he did not get injured in this episode.
I meant to mention that, and I started to tweet it, but I try not to tweet spoilers at all. But I started to say, there's been a Sam Kirk sighting.
Yep.
And I was thinking that he didn't get injured.
And uninjured.
Exactly. He did not almost die. Although he may have almost died if he had hung around any longer, because
This is true.
He quickly left the situation there. That was kind of funny that they threw him in there, I have to say. But no, it was a deep episode. It's a heavy episode. I think it's impressive for the structure and the foundation of the series that they can do Spock Amok and then turn around and do this in the next week. I think it shows how well the writers understand Star Trek and understand the universe that they're playing in and how to use it for storytelling and how to keep the audience interested. And it just really feels like Star Trek is back in the format that best suits it. And so I'm really happy to see that. I'm going to give the episode 7 defaced medallions.
Fantastic.
Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on this episode as well. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. If not, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, so if you're joining, please be sure to answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post for this episode on the timeline there, and you can share your thoughts with fellow listeners and Matthew and me right there. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose Saddle Up, and that'll come to us by Pony Express. And in social media, Instagram, Twitter, everywhere, you can find us under the username TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not thinking of additional musical references to throw into our discussion, where can people find you?
Well, you can never have too many, Chris. I'm just saying. So, when I'm not with my friends in low places there at the 602 Club, which is our other side of the network where we're talking about all things geeky that don't have to do with Star Trek, all those other fandoms we love, you can also find me on social media under the name MattRushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero. All of those places. Of course, on top of the 602 Club, you can also find me with doing literary tracks, books and comics of Star Trek. We already talked about The Orb, Chris, where you talk about Deep Space Nine and our massive love for that. We've got Warp 5. We're walking through all the episodes of Enterprise from start to finish to celebrate 20 years of that show. And then we've got The Artificial Tango, where we talked through season 2 of Picard, which is great. And we've got some things in the works to maybe, yeah, maybe we'll go back and cover season 1 or something. I don't know. Maybe it could happen. And then you can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a completed show called Outpost with Drea Kaufman, where we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then Aggressive Negotiations that I do with John Mills, which is a Star Wars podcast. So I hope you will check all of that out. Now, Chris, when you're not just, you know, sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the time go away, where can people find you?
How did you know that's what I do every evening?
I mean, who doesn't? I mean, if you got a dock where you can just enjoy the bay, why wouldn't you?
So true. When I'm not doing that, actually, maybe while I am doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network. Of course, we do the shows, Matthew, that you and I do together, which you've mentioned, and also Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time, and there's Interphase, and I'm in all sorts of episodes of various shows in the back catalog from the past 12 years of podcasting about Star Trek. So check those out if you're interested in more of my thoughts. And if you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek and social media or chat about anything, that's great. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That is my username everywhere, but Twitter is where I'm most active, and I'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without you. It takes a great deal of money to produce these shows and to get them out to you. And I just want to send a huge thanks to everyone who's supporting us right now. And if you're not, I hope that you will consider doing so. Thank you so much to everyone who is supporting the network for helping us keep this going. Well, Matthew, I'm curious what they have in store for us on the next episode of Strange New Worlds after this deep episode and the comedic one before. So we'll see if Himmer's back and what happens next time.
Well, goodness, Chris, you may be right and I may be crazy, but I think it's time to saddle up, lock and load.